This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Roshan Kanasan, and this is The Breakfast Grill. Today we're taking a look back at some of the biggest tech companies we've had on the grill. Now, the last decade has been the decade of the unicorn, and we've had a few of them on the show this year. We've had new entrants into the Malaysian market, including TransferWise and Stripe. TransferWise wants to change the way we move money around the world, while Stripe wants to power the underlying infrastructure to make the internet economy faster and better. And of course, we've also had Airbnb, the company that wants to change the way we travel. Now, as the internet economy has become so much bigger in the last decade, Stripe wants to provide the underlying infrastructure to power all of that. But payments aren't a new thing. And the question on my mind was, is it just simply a modern version of PayPal? Here's what John Collison, co-founder and president of Stripe, had to say about that when he was here in October for their launch.
Yeah, so Stripe provides software for internet businesses. And what we want to enable is actually pretty simple. We want to make it easy for businesses to accept money from their customers anywhere in the world. And you might wonder, well, okay, you're from Ireland, you started this company. How did that come about? Really, what we found was that for people building internet businesses, this was the most challenging thing for them. The fact that it's still hard, still in 2019, for people to trade online. And so we got started in the United States. We launched in the United States 8 years ago, and we've been expanding since then. And today we're launching in Malaysia, which we're pretty excited about. But again, that's the same. It's the same core idea. And so if you're a consumer, you might not see kind of the Stripe logo everywhere, but with this explosion of exciting internet applications that have been happening, Grab or Deliveroo or Fashion Valet or Amazon or something like this, a lot of the time underneath the hood, they'll be powered by Stripe.
You are the underlying system that allows these payments to go through, allowing online businesses to accept and make payments. But a lot of times when we think about payments, something like PayPal comes to mind. What have you managed to solve that PayPal didn't?
Yeah. So, and you're right that when, and I'll get to that, but when things start moving online, suddenly everything becomes a little more complex, right? Where if you're accepting cash, you can have a tin cash box. That's all pretty simple. Now, when you want to have an internet business, there's a huge amount of complexity. What we found was that PayPal, for a certain set of use cases, might have, solved them certainly kind of 10 or 15 years ago. But again, what businesses need have gotten much more complex, and the existing set of solutions hasn't kept up. And so, for example, as an internet business, you might be trying to build a subscription business. We have a company here called Shaves to You, which is using Stripe for their subscription razor service. That's something that Stripe makes it very easy to build. Or, again, maybe you're building a marketplace like a Grab, connecting riders with drivers. That's something that traditionally was very complicated that Stripe makes easy. And so all of these new internet businesses, subscription companies, marketplace companies, often operating very globally. Maybe they start in one country, but they're very quickly expanding. That's the kind of thing that Stripe makes simple, and that we had found the previous set of companies, PayPal, but many others as well, hadn't done so.
So I find the story of you going to Peter Thiel to get your first round of funding is actually really interesting, because Peter Thiel was a co-founder of PayPal. Yeah. What do you think he saw here that eventually turned seven lines of code into what is now a $35 billion company?
So I think the thing that maybe surprised people is that there's a tendency to think that these problems, one company comes along and then they're solved, right? But just like there were search engines before Google, there were payment companies before Stripe, oftentimes it takes a while to understand the problem, and the market is much bigger than people realize. And so I think what he and other early investors in Stripe saw was, despite the fact, yes, there had been some efforts in this space beforehand, the problem was by no means solved. And if you talk to anyone who was running an internet business online, they would tell you that still things were very cumbersome for them. Things weren't necessarily solved. And that's definitely our belief today. In 2019, you might think, well, we've been doing this internet thing for 20, 30 years at this stage. We kind of have it figured out. No, we don't. I mean, in Malaysia, 3% of economic activity takes place online. We think that can be an order of magnitude higher. It's really interesting to think that still in 2019, there's the opportunity for smart people to create really exciting companies. There's all these opportunities that haven't been taken yet.
So payment systems on their own is just one part of the, let's call it the payment value system. Are you planning to move beyond that? Because I think in the US, you're looking at in-store services as well. What's that journey going to look like?
Yeah, and we already have started moving beyond just the kind of core payments to some extent. So the first thing is, I mean, even just getting the core payments right is quite complicated. You know, when we were expanding to Malaysia, one of the things that we're always very cognizant of is that we don't want to be the American company. Well, first off, you know, well, we're not American, but, you know, we don't want to be that American company coming along and just taking the same product that works well in America and trying to make it work here. Because, by the way, that's not going to succeed. And so in the case of Malaysia, it's important that we can accept cards, we can accept Alipay payments, we can accept FPX for people who want to pay with their bank account, and things like that. But even just getting the core payments correct, that's a bigger challenge than maybe people realize. But then we try to, on top of that, provide a lot of the software that makes running a business easy. Because when you talk to a business owner and you ask them, why did you start this business? They never say, well, I'm just really passionate about accounting, or, you know, I just really love filling out paperwork or something like that. There's always some reason that they started a business that, you know, we have the Rage Coffee folks, and they're a Stripe customer, and they're really passionate about coffee. They probably didn't want to solve all this business administrativa. And so we tried to continue to take all that back office stuff that isn't strategic for the business, and they didn't even really want to be spending a lot of time on, and simplify that. And so, you know, we can provide their billing system. We can, you know, help prevent fraud, you know, payments fraud in the business. We just launched in the United States the other week a corporate card to help them manage spending. And so, you know, this is one of the things that's often challenging for businesses. So we keep talking to businesses that use Stripe and just say, what's still painful? You know, in what ways is your life hard? And go from there.
So essentially, it comes down to making it easy for businesses to do business online and make sure that those payments are as frictionless as possible. And on that same note, TransferWise wants to do the same thing for international remittances, making it cheaper, faster, and quite possibly better. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Good morning and welcome back to the Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Today we're taking a look at some of the conversations we've had with tech companies that want to change the way we work, live, and travel. And amongst them was the conversation I had with TransferWise, the company that wants to change the way we move money across the world. Now, on the back of their Malaysian launch just over a month ago, I sat down with co-founder Tavit Henricus to discuss how they're disrupting the banks. Now, TransferWise is using P2P essentially to make these transfers, but I had my concerns about the liquidity in the system.
So when we started TransferWise, we believed in the peer-to-peer idea, and it was, in a way, it was kind of a prototype for us for building it, because that's how we got started about a dozen years ago, myself and Christo and a few other friends sending money between Estonia and UK. It was done purely on a peer-to-peer fashion. When we launched TransferWise in 2011, we very quickly, pretty much by the end of the first day, realized that it's never going to be perfectly matching. You always have more money in one way than the other way. But we felt that it would be a bad reason for slowing things down or thinking differently. So we kind of took it as a challenge for us to figure out how we can make it work in a world where we don't have perfect liquidity. So what happens is very simple. When we don't have enough liquidity on one side and we go out to the financial markets, you know, because we are moving billions of dollars every month, we have access to wholesale liquidity rates. So if someone is sending money and we can't match it internally, we automatically buy on the market at that moment. And, you know, for us, this is no big deal. This is business as usual. Customers don't really know, or do they really care about how it happens?
So basically, you step in whenever there's a mismatch. So does that mean that I'm always guaranteed a transfer?
Exactly. You are always guaranteed a transfer. we kind of realized pretty quickly that that's really important for users.
On the question of price, on average, 5 to 10% is conventionally what is charged by international money transfers. Conversely, you on a, let's say, on a pound to euro transfer, the upfront fee is about 80 pence plus 0.35%. That translates to about, let's say you're transferring £1,000, that's about 0.43%, which is a phenomenal rate. How are you doing this and still turning a profit?
So key to this is clever use of technology. If you think about the competition, and when I say competition, I really mean banks, because most people will go to a bank to make an international transfer. So that's kind of what we're up against. If you think about banks, and you know, you have floors full of people who are essentially moving papers from one pile to another, and they're being helped by a mainframe computer in the basement. You know, the systems were built dozens of years ago, and they don't operate very efficiently. You know, on the other hand, TransferWise was built in the past years. We're using technology as much as we can. We are making sure that in every country we're plugged in into the local payment network as closely as possible. So that's what enabled us to do it very quickly for a very low price. We do not have a branch network to support. There's only one TransferWise branch, that's your smartphone. You know, the only bank branch that matters nowadays is your smartphone. So by not having a branch network, by using technology, that's why we can do things so quickly and for such a low price.
So David seemed quite critical of the bank. So I asked him about the competition that he's facing with them. And he said that they're making it easy for TransferWise.
So if we look around the world, then we typically see that people go to their bank when they want to make an international transfer. So and that was the picture 8 years ago when we first launched, and it still is a picture in pretty much everywhere we go. And luckily, banks are making it easy to compete with them.
Elaborate on that. Why do you say that? I mean, we were talking about legacy systems earlier. Is that the only thing that's keeping them from entering?
So if you go to a bank, then first of all, it is still the case in 2019 that there are banks that don't offer it in their mobile application, maybe not even on their website, that you have to go to a branch to do it. I mean, it's luckily becoming more and more rare that that's the case, but it still happens sometimes. Next up, it takes 3-4 days for your transfer to reach a recipient using a bank. That's kind of a long time to wait. And then lastly, it's really expensive, you know. You end up losing between 5 and 10%. So, you know, kind of, if that's all visible on paper in front of you, then there's no reason anybody would ever go to a bank. There is a but, there's a however, which is about transparency. Banks make it really hard for you to know what is the markup on the exchange rate. There are banks which tell you, we do money transfer for free. So they charge nothing up front, but guess what? The markup on the exchange rate, it's going to be between 5 and 10% then. So banks are pretty sneaky when it comes to this. And I think the whole industry is lacking a lot of transparency. Luckily, I think the ice is melting around this. You know, last December, the European Commission passed a law which says that all financial institutions in Europe need to show the markup on the exchange rate. So this is now going to become a law in all countries over the next few months, so I'm pretty excited to see what that means for Europe. A similar discussion and investigation is happening in Australia. So I think that we'll see much more transparency, which makes it much easier for people to compare, and which means many more people will be very upset at their banks.
So, end of the day, especially I think in particularly in the Western world, you still need access to bank accounts, correct? Almost all your transfers there happen through bank accounts. Can you really compete with the banks if you still need access to those bank accounts? What's stopping them from blocking you out?
Well, I think if any bank wanted to block us out as such, they would get into a nice discussion with the regulator, which would not really make them look any good. So I'm not really worried about that. And also, given the high cost structure that a bank has, it's typically very hard for them to compete in this. You know, but what is an option what banks can do is they could partner with TransferWise. So we're very happy now to talk to banks and enter into a partnership with them. Second biggest bank in France has signed a partnership with TransferWise. Today we have 8 banks live around the world where you can use TransferWise inside those banks' web or mobile application.
And a little bit earlier you were saying that how
The banks were making it easy for you to compete with them. So if that's the case, what is protecting you from other competitors coming in? What's your moat around the business right now?
So moat we have is, I would say, two things. One is it's a network we've built. You know, we have 1,800 people working at TransferWise, operating and building the service. And, you know, it turns out it's really hard to build what we're doing. You know, every country we go into takes a couple years. So as long as we keep on investing in continuing to improve the service, I think it's very hard, practically impossible for anyone to catch up to us. You know, payments is a scale business. The more payments we process, the lower we can make the price. So it's a bit of a virtuous cycle where it's very hard for anyone else to catch up. You know, I guess the good thing is that the area of finance is so large, as there are so many different niches anyone can occupy. So just as I would say, any people need to figure out what's the one thing they want to be best at and then partner with other people for the rest. So, you know, if there are companies like, for example, a local e-wallet in Malaysia, you know, they're great at being a local wallet and the local payment mechanism, but there's no point for them trying to compete to do international payments. So for that, it would make sense to partner with TransferWise. You can get, you know, a very simple e-wallet to send money between Singapore and Malaysia, but that's only one corridor. You know, people want to send money from Malaysia to US, from Malaysia to Argentina, from Malaysia to Japan. So I think that's where the global networks that we have comes to play. You know, it takes a lot of work to replicate that. You know, we've grown our volume 70% in Asia over the past year, so it makes a lot of sense for them to operate an e-wallet. But do they want to replicate what we've done over the past 8 years, or are there ways to do things together?
Now, I guess we'll have to wait and see how TransferWise builds its relationships with the local e-wallets and the banks, and whether they'll be able to turn this possible competition between them into a collaboration and partnership. Now, shifting gears away from payment systems and international money transfers, let's take a look at Airbnb, the biggest unicorn we've had on the grill this year. They still haven't announced a date for IPO, saying that they don't really need it. But the biggest concerns, I guess, around Airbnb today, how do you balance concerns between your users and the community around those users? And this is exactly what Kusu Chuang asked Mike Orgill, the general manager for Southeast Asia, when he was on the grill in January this year.
Well, Mike, let's step back from the legislation and look at it from a practical standpoint. If you're a landowner, if you're a property owner, it does make sense from an excess supply perspective to monetize some of that. But then for your neighbors and for your residents association, there are all kinds of concerns, whether it's a safety, it's privacy, in fact, even in certain cases, dampening property values. If you have all kinds of people from all parts of the world coming in at all times of the night, who won't have access to your condos or your apartments. Now, those concerns are perfectly valid, legislation notwithstanding.
They certainly are valid, and I think it's important that that's why you have the right regulations and rules in place that that address those types of issues. You know, when we've seen other countries that have experienced this, so for example, Sydney in Australia, this has been a concern for them. They created new legislation where basically there was an industry council that would receive complaints, and if you received more than a certain number of complaints, you would be banned from Airbnb, and you'd be banned from other properties around, banned from other platforms as well. And we welcome that because we think that's the right way to deal with this, is to actually go after the people that are causing the problems and to mitigate those concerns directly. But I think the reality is that the vast majority of people who are hosts and guests are going to be good neighbors. They want to be good citizens. They want to be connected with the people around them. So this is where I do think that targeted regulation is important. Secondly, you know, Airbnb understands that this is an important part of our existence, is to be connected with these local communities. So we've launched a product which is called the Friendly Buildings Program. And what it does is it allows property owners to get visibility into who in their building is hosting, when are guests coming, what are the details, and actually it allows the management committee to take a portion of the revenue from the Airbnb host and actually be able to put that towards their condo facilities.
How quickly are you rolling out that service to other parts of the world?
So we've rolled it out in the U.S. and it's across the country now. We're finishing development on it and hope to be able to roll it out more this year.
Okay, because that makes the ecosystem that much more palatable. But, I mean, these are trying times for platform sharing sites like yourselves. You know, for example, in China, there have been all kinds of concerns with ride-sharing services, ditto for Uber in the developed world. Now, I guess you guys who run the service have got to take the steps to make it that much more safe and secure and private for your users. And conversely, I read that in August last year, you sued the city of New York's contesting a new law. I think the New York State wants you to require you to share host names and addresses with the authorities every month. And that's something you pushed back on. Why?
Well, in that case, I think in the United States, it was a bit of an overstep. And I think, was it last week, the judge ruled in our favor. But I think the broader point is that, you know, there are steps that have to be taken. There are reasonable roles for platforms. And we think that we have a responsibility to be responsive to the concerns of governments and communities. At the same time, there are certain things that we think are a step too far and are unnecessary. And in the case of New York, that certainly was one of the measures that we said was unnecessary. And also our host came out and said the exact same thing. These are, you know, tens of thousands of people in a place like New York were coming out and saying that they think that their city is overstepping. And so, look, I think that they, you know, platforms are always smart when they understand that they have a role to play, that they need to be responsible. And that's always, you know, our perspective is that we need to find ways to make this work. We need to address the underlying concerns. And we reach out to governments proactively to say, how can we start addressing the concerns early? Because we know that governments are always going to move slower than the technology that's disrupting industries around them.
Now, concerns aside, how does Airbnb benefit Malaysia overall? Because they don't seem to have much of a direct investment approach when it comes to the countries that they are in.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that if you think about a platform business like Airbnb, it's not necessarily going to be what Airbnb is putting in terms of its direct capital, but rather the money that's flowing into the market. So when a host is able to receive a guest, they're the ones that are earning the income, and Airbnb is taking a small fee off of that. So if you look in the past year, we're talking hundreds of millions of ringgit that are going into the local economy quite directly. In terms of what Airbnb is doing to take advantage of this growth in Malaysia, we're trying to extend more and more services and offerings to Malaysia. Two that I find particularly exciting are, first, Airbnb Experiences, which allows local hospitality entrepreneurs to be able to connect with guests. So whether that be a hike in the mountains behind the Klang Valley, whether that be someone who's a curry puff maker, being able to share that and unlock economic opportunity on the experiences side is really meaningful. We now have about 120 experiences and that's growing quickly for us. The other one that we've started to do is actually roll out something called Airbnb Plus, which Airbnb Plus are listings that have been verified and vetted by someone who's actually inspected the home, and they meet a certain quality threshold for us. So we've rolled that out starting in December last year, and are really excited about being able to bring more of these Airbnb Plus listings online in Malaysia.
Now, you can catch all these conversations on BFM.my or our BFM app, available on the BFM App Store or Google Play. You can also find them on Spotify. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanasan for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.